I like Grand Seiko because it's Japanese. It feels Japanese. It speaks with the Japanese DNA. And that's when both really Seiko and Grand Seiko are at their best. I don't like very much when you have watches that kind of resemble a Swiss watch. If I want a Swiss watch or a Swiss looking watch, and I have many of those in my collection, I'll go ahead and I'll buy a Swiss watch. You know, I like Grand Seiko because they're different, because they're not Swiss. And this is not to bash on the Swiss brands. It's just that that identity is what makes it different.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulvern, and this is Hodinkee Radio. We've got a super fun show for you this week. It's all about Grand Seiko collecting. We've got an amazing trio of collectors here to help us understand what makes collecting Grand Seiko so special and so different. Here's where I'd normally introduce them, but I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Up first, we've got JP Vicente.
Hi, I'm JP Vicente. I'm in finance, more specifically in the asset management industry. In terms of what watches kind of mean to me, watches are an utterly human instrument. You know, it's a human instrument that measures a human perceived concept, which is time. So not to get too philosophical, but time is relative, as Einstein has showed us. But we live in a Newtonian world here. And the fact that it's a mechanical watch can also transcend our own time, our own existence, and we'll live on, creates sort of an enduring legacy. That's what fascinates me about these little pieces.
Next up, we've got Stefan Molin.
Yes, so my name is Stefan Molin. I'm a 52-year-old Swedish guy, obviously from Sweden, and my occupation is semiconductor sales. For me, a watch is essentially a technical object for me. That looks good. And also it's something that you always carry with you. So, I mean, you can use it, of course, obviously to see the time and sometimes the date. But if you take like a diver's watch with a turnable ring, you can actually use it for timing things, like when you're cooking pasta or have something on the grill. And also I think the watches can help you put yourself in a certain mood. I mean, when I go swimming, I always take a diver's watch, even though I'm not diving. If I go to the opera, I take a nice dress watch. That makes you feel more in the mood, in the right mood for that certain thing that you want to do.
And coming to us from Australia, we've got Daniel Young.
My name is Daniel Young, and I don't really have any fancy jobs like the other two guys here, but I'm a school teacher in Sydney, Australia.
That's a fancy job.
Yeah, seriously.
Seriously.
Don't, you can't downplay that.
Don't demean it, man.
It's always fun getting terrorized by little kids, man. So to me, I'd say watches are, I would say that they're an expression of who you are. It's interesting, like going through everybody's collection, you see it with your Talking Watches episodes, which I love. And you can see where people have collected watches from different moments of their lives, reflects on what they liked at that particular time. And I think that's really cool. So they, in a way, they're kind of physical pieces of your own history.
We're going to cover a lot of ground today, everything from our favorite references to what makes the Grand Seiko community such a special part of the watch collecting world. But first, a message from our partners, Grand Seiko. This year, the brand is celebrating its 60th anniversary. Traditionally, in Japanese culture, a person's 60th birthday represents a moment of rebirth, and Grand Seiko is celebrating accordingly. In addition to the new Spring Drive and High Beat calibers, as well as a host of other new introductions to the catalog, Grand Seiko has released a set of four limited edition watches specifically to celebrate its 60th anniversary. All four watches feature rich dials in Grand Seiko's signature shade of blue, and each highlights a different facet of Grand Seiko's wide-reaching expertise. First is the SBGH-281, an automatic watch with a High Beat caliber inside. The simple three-hands and date layout lets you admire the wonderful blue dial with its red accents and the quick-moving red seconds hand too. This is a watch for every day, and one that will look just as good in 60 years as it does right now. There's a second automatic limited edition, the STGK-015, but this one's a dedicated women's watch. The smaller 27.8mm case features a ring of diamonds on the bezel, as well as diamond hour markers that sparkle against the blue dial. It's still a hard-wearing automatic Grand Seiko, just in an elegant, refined package. Then there's a pair of high-precision quartz watches to round things out. The SBGP007 in the Heritage Collection, and the SBGP015 in the Sport Collection. These both use a new quartz movement that allows the hour hand to be jumped in 1 hour increments without stopping the seconds hand. This means you don't have to interrupt the extremely precise movement, which is accurate to plus or minus just 5 seconds per year. The two executions ensure there's a style for any taste. To learn more about these four 60th anniversary watches and to take a look at Grand Seiko's full lineup, visit GrandSeiko.com. All right, let's jump into the show. Hey guys, thanks so much for joining us. We've got people across what, like 14 hours worth of time zones here.
Yeah. Hey Steve.
This is easily the most international and logistically complicated episode of Hodinkee Radio we've done. We're at 90 something here, and this is the first one where I think we've got people in three countries on the mics, but. I want to make sure we also get the origin stories for each of you guys out of the way kind of up front, like how you got into watches, since that's the bulk of what we're going to talk about here for the next hour. So I figure we'll start at the very beginning. Maybe we'll start with Daniel on this one. How did you get interested in watches in the first place?
So growing up in, I guess, Sydney, Australia, and in a Chinese and Cambodian community, watches tends to be something that a lot of Asians like to wear. They do tend to go for the more blingy watches, unfortunately. Nothing wrong with that, though. And they do tend to, I remember, they do tend to choose brands that are, I guess, more safe. I remember seeing a lot of uncles at family events. You've always got the different types of uncles. You got the ones that are in the corner, you know, doing their own thing. And then you got the ones that are like, I guess the life of the party. And those are the cool uncles, the ones that are wearing like these really cool two-tone Datejust. Datejust seems to be a thing with Asian men for some reason. I don't mean to generalize, but I'm just talking about from my own experience. And I guess I remember thinking that, man, these guys are so cool. And like, when I grow up, I want to make sure that I look like these guys. But then I guess my tastes tend to... It veered off into another direction. I remember getting my first Seiko 5, and I remember wearing the watch, and the person who gave it to me told me that, hey, this doesn't use a battery. It actually, it's powered by your own movements. And I'm like, what? No battery? And so I remember turning it over and looking at the case back and thinking, whoa, this is like a whole nother dimension, man. This is like looking through the case back of this thing is like a sci-fi movie. And I remember thinking, what is this thing? And I remember being hooked from that ever since.
Very cool. JP, how about for you?
Well, I guess my love for watches really started when I got a Timex, you know, version of the Cartier tank. You know, it was a knockoff, and I didn't know that at the time. I must have been 6 or 7 years old. And I don't really quite remember who gave it to me, but how I came to own the watch, but I think it was an uncle who gave it to me because he knew I could tell time since I was a young boy. But the watch didn't work when he gave it to me. So my mom and I went to visit the neighborhood watchmaker, and at the time watchmaking shops existed like cobblers. You know, they were, you know, you had your neighborhood guy that you went to because people wore a lot of mechanical watches then. And they relied on him to fix, you know, the watches. So I remember going there, and the watchmaker's name, I remember to this day, was Pasquale. He was an Italian guy. And I don't know how it happened, but he and I kind of started a conversation there. And he took me to his workbench, and he actually started showing me his tools. And it was the first time I saw watch movement, you know, the first time I saw an escapement. And I was totally hooked from that very young age. And it's been like that for basically 4 decades now. And I really, that's my first watch story that I truly remember.
That's awesome. Stefan, how about for you? When did the journey start for you?
Yeah, I know exactly when it started. So I was 8 years old in 1976. So I got a 50s, I think it was a woman's watch actually, from my mother. So it was a simple three-hander mechanical watch. And I remember I was so amazed that something this tiny actually had some cogs and wheels and stuff inside, and it could show the time. So that really impressed me. But I think the biggest thing was in 1979, when I got my first digital watch. So one with the stopwatch, so you could time things. I remember I wanted a Seiko because a friend of mine had one, but they were too expensive. So I got some knockoff version, but it looked exactly the same. And one thing that we used it for in Sweden those days, maybe you remember Ingmar Stenmark, the downhill skier that was one of the best. He was the best, I think, worldwide. So when he skied, actually in schools, we stopped lessons and they rolled in a big TV, a fat TV, in the classroom. And everybody watched when he was skiing and competing. And then, of course, you wanted to time his skiing yourself with your digital watch. So even though the telly showed exactly the time, you wanted to do it yourself. And the other thing you used it for, you could, if you took it off, and you held it so you could push the buttons against the table. The competition was to be the quickest, on and off. So you needed to have one that showed 1/100th of a second. Because you could actually do it in 1/100th of a second. So push it down the table, on, and then push it again really quickly, off. So that's what we used it for. And throughout the 80s, most of my watches were digital watches, and in 1988 I got a Casio G-Shock round one, the DW5700, that I used throughout my military service, and it held together until almost 20 years later, and then the resin got dried up and was actually completely broken. But I never changed battery in that watch, so I think it kept the same battery for 18 years, something like this. And then throughout my youth, always when we passed watch shops, I stopped looking at everything, always. And I do remember from the 80s also, my father had, he was in banking, so he had these finance magazines, and you always had Rolex advertisement on the back. And of course, you admired those GMTs and Day Dates and Submariners, even though you couldn't buy one, but you could admire.
Mm. Do you remember when you got your first sort of like what we would say maybe is like a nice watch? I hate using that word, but your first mechanical watch, your first sort of like high end like luxury watch, maybe.
Yeah, the more expensive one, but that was in 1999. It was a Sinn 6000 Finanzplatzuhr. That I bought from Germany. And I really, really liked it. And the reason why I bought it was someone called, I forgot his name now, but he wrote a very nice watch review online. And that made me buy the watch, actually.
That's super cool. That's a really cool first kind of like entry point into mechanical watches. JP, what was your kind of like gateway, let's say?
My first great watch was actually a Lanco. You know, and that my mom had given my father as a wedding present. I think she gave it to me when I was close to 10. Sadly, I guess sadly, I don't have it anymore. We had an incident that our house was burglarized once, and actually, unfortunately, that watch was stolen. And I don't remember the reference, but I know it was a small 34 millimeter watch with a gold case and a gold dial. And it was just awesome. I'm really sad I don't have it anymore. But that little Lanco is great. And I still have, and then my dad had another one. He bought a Movado that replaced the Lanco. And I own that one today. So I still have it. It's a tiny one. Yeah, it's a 34 millimeter watch as well, but I still have that. But my first great watch, I think, was actually that Lanco. I wore it every day. It was great.
That's super cool. Daniel, how about you?
My first great watch was a Longines. So that I got that after the Seiko 5. I don't have it anymore as well. And I remember loving the thing. And again, it was the case back. I know it was just an ETA, but But I remember looking at the case back, and that was like a one step above the Seiko 5, the finishing. And I remember thinking, wow, this is art, man. This is actually art on your wrist. Then unfortunately, after like I did flip that to get a Tudor Black Bay, and that was a watch that I did love for quite a few years. And I would probably say the Tudor Black Bay was probably my first nice watch, as in luxury watch.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, we all find our own kind of our own paths in. Sometimes it's through family, sometimes it's through our own interests, sometimes it's a kind of weird combination of the two. But I want to make sure we get relatively quickly into Grand Seiko. I mean, that's why we're here. I mean, the three of you participated in our collector profile series a little over a year ago now, I guess, maybe 2 years ago almost. So I wonder, you know, we now know how you got into watches, how you kind of brought it to the next level, became real enthusiasts, started buying, you know, quote unquote luxury mechanical watches. But I wonder, what was your first taste of Grand Seiko? Because especially a couple of years ago, it was a much more niche thing. It was you really had to kind of be in the know to know Grand Seiko. So maybe let's start with JP on this one. JP, do you remember your first encounter with Grand Seiko?
Oh yeah, I'd say that I started paying attention to Grand Seiko. It was, I don't remember exactly the year, but it was in the 90s, probably in the mid 90s. Okay. And a friend of mine from Japan introduced it to me, and he had a vintage 44 GS, and I simply fell in love with the watch, and it was so different from anything I'd seen before, the angles and the way the case was designed. And back then you had to really know someone in Japan to be able to get a Grand Seiko. You know, obviously at that point they were not making the watches. Well, technically, you know, the quartz, you know, Grand Seiko quartz was being made or reintroduced, but if you wanted a mechanical vintage Grand Seiko, you kind of either have had to know someone in Japan or you had to visit Japan. And then the internet came about, and things got a lot easier than when I discovered the brand. But I discovered the brand in the pre-internet days, and I thought that I was the only guy in the Western world that actually knew about it, you know. And it was beyond a stretch to call it a niche brand. I mean, no one knew the brand. But gladly, that has changed quite a lot since then, and you know, we can certainly discuss the evolution of that brand, you know, outside of Japan. But that was, that was my first encounter. That's kind of how I started, and I bought and sold some vintage pieces back then, and you know, I kind of settled a little bit on the current collection. But yeah, that's kind of how it started. I got the bug, as they say.
Nice. And Daniel, you're the one who's geographically closest to Japan. Was it any easier for you to get into it, or was it just as difficult?
Well, I didn't get into Grand Seiko in the 90s like JP did. I'm not saying anything about our age difference, man. So, but I did within the last 5 years, and fortunately for me, the internet and I guess Instagram was already there, so it did exist. So like I was saying before, I did. The first watch that I fell in love with was the Seiko 5. And I remember wanting to learn more about, I guess, Seiko as a brand. And I remember joining up with different forums and these Facebook groups that are out there.
Yeah.
And being connected to all of these guys internationally. And so what I noticed was there were heaps of like collectors that were from like countries like, I guess, around Asia, like Singapore, Hong Kong, and of course, Japan. And so going through all the Seikos that they had, they were posting. And then I remember seeing these weird models that were really sparkly. They just sparkled unlike the other Seikos out there. Sure, there was a Presage, which was beautiful. But then there was this brand called Grand Seiko. And I looked at it and I was like, two things striked out for me. I guess how shiny and polished the cases were. And of course, the dials, which are, I guess, the two things that Grand Seiko is very famous for, apart from their movements. And I remember, I guess, doing further research and then coming across the first Grand Seiko from 1960. which both JP and Stefan have, and I'm very jealous of you two. And I remember just falling in love with the brand then, and then I started to research on modern Grand Seiko, and I fell in love with the SBGW33 that actually Gary mentioned in the previous podcast.
Yeah,
I wanted that for myself. I couldn't afford it at the time. And then somehow I came across the SBGW031. And after doing some research, to me, that was like the most accurate, I guess, reinterpretation of the first Grand Seiko without replicating it. And I thought that was kind of cool because the brand is about innovation, right? And yeah, so I bought that watch and I've and you know, when you just have an object and the more that you look at it, I don't know, I think there's a psychological term for it. I'm not sure what it is, but the more you look at something, the more you stare at it, the more you fall in love with it. And that's pretty much what happened with me with the 031.
Nice. And Stefan, for you, what was your entry into Grand Seiko?
I have to blame, similar to JP, I have to blame the internet. So late 90s, early 2000, I was heavily into divers watches, and Seiko is, as you know, very good at divers. And that made me find forums like Seiko Citizen Watch Forum and Time Zone. And then on there, I saw something called Grand Seiko. And I thought that was really, really interesting because I was completely unaware that Seiko did something like this and that they started in 1960. So and one of the key things, I think, was that they, when you learned that they actually beat all the Swiss in the chronometer competitions in the 60s. So that was really, really interesting. So, and with the internet, you can learn a lot. I mean, you can read up on all the history. And I was just amazed about the history of Seiko, but in this case, Grand Seiko. And I think in 2004-05, the first spring drives came about, Grand Seiko spring drives. And then I remember reading something in the late 80s or early 90s in a popular science magazine about Seiko trying to get rid of the battery. And I remember when I read it that, wow, this is really cool. And now here, 15 years later, the first watches were basically released with this kind of movement. And that made me, and that and the look of the SBGE001, so the Grand Seiko GMT spring drive, that the look of that watch was just wow. So I knew I had to have it. So that was my first Grand Seiko that I bought in 2005.
That's great. Yeah, I want to, you know, now that we know how you guys got into it, I mean, it's three sort of different paths, different entry points, but there's some overlap there. And I wonder how you guys would explain the appeal of Grand Seiko to somebody new. I think, you know, the four of us are all Grand Seiko fans. I'm wearing, you know, for people who are watching this on YouTube, I'm wearing my vintage Grand Seiko today, but yeah, I wonder if somebody, you know, who's maybe already a little bit interested in watches, they're not totally new to the watch world, you know, were to come to you and say like, okay, I know Rolex, I know Omega, I know Longines, I know, you know, all the big Swiss brands. But like, what's the deal with Grand Seiko? How would you try to explain that to them? And I'm just going to leave that open. You guys, and anyone can answer this. You can respond to each other. I'm curious how as collectors you would explain your passion for the brand.
To me, I think over the years now, what I think is one of the biggest things with Grand Seiko is actually the attention to detail. I mean, you can look at the watch with the microscope even, and nothing, you cannot find any flaws, basically. So that of course, the attention to detail and quality, that will give you a very good watch and also a very pleasant watch to look at. I mean, the visuals for me are key with all these facets and how the watches play with light and things like this. So that would be my take on this.
Yeah, I'll jump right there. And I think I agree. I mean, for me, it's just one word. It's quality, quality, and quality, you know. But I like to think about it in quality, or to think about quality both in relative and absolute terms, you know. So in relative terms, if you think about it, it's virtually impossible to find the level of finish that you get with the Grand Seiko at a comparable price at other brands at this point. It just is, you know, just like Stefan just mentioned, you know, if you go deep into the watch, the dial, the way the dials are actually put together, the, you know, the composition of it, the hands and the way they're finished, the movement itself, even though, the actual mechanical movements of the regular Grand Seikos are not going to be as finished as what the Micro Artist Studio is doing, but it's for that price point, it's just really, really good. And although I would say prices have come up since the brand became a separate brand in 2017, it's still a quality leader in the space. But there's also the absolute term. I mean, the quality of the brand is exceptional, even if you remove the price out of the equation. I mean, I think that that's not to say that price is not an object. It's just to say that the quality kind of sort of stands on its own, and it's a superior, quite frankly, to higher priced hand pieces in my opinion anyway. So if you're, I guess, yeah, just to, you know, I guess if you're a newbie and you're looking for a high end watch, I mean, it's hard to find something a little bit, but you know, for that, for a specific price point, it's hard to find anything more appealing to me anyway.
Mm. Yeah. So I would say pretty much what Stefan and JP have said, and also add that, like, who doesn't like Japan? And I would say that, like, so Grand Seiko watches, it's pretty much a whole country on your wrist. So what their culture believes in terms of, like, never taking shortcuts and having that meticulous attention to detail in anything, even like you've seen Marie Kondo and how she folds her clothes. It's the same thing with the watches. So that level of, I guess, of detail, it's clear in their watches. And also the brand's all about innovation as well. Even though Grand Seiko does tend to refer back to their historical icons, like the 44 GS, they also look towards the future, which I don't know if I can confidently say that other brands are doing that, like, no hate, but I guess, but Grand Seiko is about moving forward as well. And it's about both engineering and art, which is a cool fusion, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I like that a lot about wearing the one country on your wrist. I think that the cool thing about Grand Seiko, to me anyway, is what differentiates it from the Swiss brands. And this is not to say that the Swiss brands are better or worse or vice versa. I mean, I own my collection is not only Grand Seikos. I mean, I own a whole bunch of Swiss watches and I love them. But I think that the reason why it's interesting to think about Grand Seiko is because of because it's Japanese. It has a very unique concept of design. And I think that the culture of the country is really translated in the way that the watches come to be. So I agree with Daniel on that. I think it's actually a really good way to put it.
Yeah, I think that's really, really fascinating. And, you know, thinking about, you know, the things specifically, the last two sort of comments from JP and Daniel, you know, there's two sides of something that I think are actually the same coin. You know, one is the unique sort of relationship between past and future, the way that Grand Seiko sort of balances looking back at icons like the 44 GS while also creating a totally new type of high beat movement, kind of all at the same time, is sort of unique. And it's not, I think, the approach that many, or if any, Swiss watchmakers have taken. And I think the other side of that is the sort of like inherent Japanese-ness of these watches. And I think those two things, one is maybe a manifestation of the other and vice versa. And I wonder if you guys have any thoughts about that, about the relationship between innovation and history and how that may or may not be tied to the sort of like Japanese quality of Grand Seiko watches.
I think that, you know, just to level set, I mean, like, let's think about a little bit of the history here and talk about Taro Tanaka and the Grammar of Design School, right? That's just kind of where it started. And he had his hand, you know, in the in the 57 GS, but I think that the real, like the first one that really came out with that kind of Japanese-ness that we were talking about was the 44 GS. And, you know, they came out and they specified key tenets, you know, if you will, that particular brand was going to have, you know. So they talked about legibility, they talked about precision, they talked about finish, they talked about comfort on the wrist. And the watches did not have any mechanical complications at that time. And all vintage Grand Seikos are dress watches, you know. So yep. That's what happened in that period of time, right? From 1960 through 1974, somebody argued, you know, they were still making them since 1975. But call it that period, that 15-year period in which they were producing those, which is now the vintage Grand Seikos, were mostly dress watches. And they had a tremendous amount of variations and dials, et cetera, but that's kind of what it was. And then they had to relaunch the brand. And they came out, I think it was in 1988, right, that they came out with the quartz. And then, you know, we had to wait until like 1998 for them to reintroduce the mechanical movements again with the 9S series and reintroduce the mechanical Grand Seikos. But and it presented a different challenge because they started making dress watches, right? A lot of them were inspired by vintage watches, but then they started making divers and they started making chronos. But those tenets that I was just talking about in terms of legibility, precision, finish, et cetera, and the grammar of design spirit, I think they were all translated into the modern pieces. And I think that's what is so interesting. They were able to, let's say, quote unquote, pick it up where they, you know, where they had left it, you know. And I think they did really well in terms of translating that history. And we can go into the details and examples, you know, like if you look at a vintage 44 and you look at the SBGJ 005 or any of the SBGJs, you know, that series, you know, which is a reinterpretation of that case, you know, I can see the influence, you know, and that's not easy to do. And I think that is in large part the work of, you know, and there are several, I guess, heroes in the Japanese history of watchmaking, even though Japan as a country and as a culture, they don't talk about specific individuals. But Nobuhiro Kasuji is amazing, you know, and he was the one who was basically able to translate all that kind of, call it knowledge or creativity that Taro Tanaka brought to the table, you know, and translate it into modern pieces. So I actually had the pleasure of meeting him in Japan, and I asked him what he was his favorite vintage design, and he said, "Yeah, by far the 44. You know, that was it." And I was like, "Okay, you know, it's awesome that, you know, I agree with him. Let's put it this way." And when I asked him his favorite model design, he actually pointed to the SVGM 221. Right, which is technically influenced by the case of the 3180, which is the first Grand Seiko. So it's interesting because you see that kind of like even the SVGM 221 or which is the same case as the SVGR 061 or 261. It's the one with the cream dial. One's GMT, the other one's not. And it's you can see it there. You can see the polished surfaces, and it's really cool. So that's how I think about it. And there's the technology part too. I know it's a long-winded answer, but as far as technology is concerned, I think it's worth pointing out that Sua has always been the mainstay and always stayed at the forefront of technological innovation, right? And by Sua, I mean, which is now the Shujiri plant, you know, and there was always that competition between Sua and Daini, which is in Morioka. But they always stay that, and that's true today as well. They're the ones, you know, in Sua making the quartz and the spring drive movements. And Dana has always been the rabble, in my view. And they continue to be true to their horological, you know, rabble roots by sticking to the mechanical movements. And the new movement, the 9S A5, is a good example of that. So it's really interesting to see how that history is translating into the future, so to speak.
I don't know how I'm going to top JP's.
That's how I feel every time I have a conversation with JP. I'm just like, how am I? What am I contributing here?
I got a pen and wrote some notes down. So my answer is not as detailed and I guess elaborate as that. But what I will say is I was thinking about like how how I've got like, so in Australia, we're very, and I'm sure the US is the same. I'm not sure about Sweden, Stefan. Sorry, man. but anyway, so in Australia, we are a very multicultural country. And so what that means is the students that we have in our classroom come from a lot of different backgrounds. So before we can learn about each other's backgrounds, it's important that, I guess, as educators, that we get the kids to understand who they are first before you can go off and learn about other people. So if I was to relate that back to your question, Stephen, I think Grant Seiko needs to understand their historical roots. Where did they come from? What is our philosophy? And Tanaka's grammar of design, as JP mentioned, that is the root of it all. So that's the root of our case designs. They need to play with the light and shadow. And I think from there, once they understand that, then that's when they can start to innovate and marry the two, I guess, philosophies and concepts. In one of my Instagram posts, I mentioned a word called Kaizen. Sorry, Japanese people out there, if I pronounce that wrong, but it's the concept of always developing and always improving, never remaining the same. And I think Grant Seiko also embodies that. Even in 1960, it was always about innovating. Let's be better. Let's be better. We can always improve. And I think that's what Grant Seiko is. I don't know. That's what I think.
I think very, very good answers from both JP and Daniel, and I fully agree. Especially this on improvement. To me, Seiko and Grant Seiko has always wanted to do things better. One thing, when they stopped with Grant Seiko in the mid-70s, I actually am one of the people that do not believe they really stopped, because the grand quatches that they had, I think those took the place of mechanical Grand Seikos, basically until the mid-80s. And if you look at Grand Quatch watches, you see the same type of design language as you see in vintage Grand Seiko pieces. You see a lot of different variants of dials. Some of the dial patterns you can actually find in modern Grand Seikos, like the Blizzard, for instance, and things like this. And quartz was the brand new, the best thing you could have at that time. And then ultimately, when they came with the spring drive, so they never stopped. And spring drive in itself, I think it's really interesting, since I think he started, I forgot his name now, but he started in 1977. And I think they released the first commercially available spring drive watch in 1999. So 22 years later. And to me, that shows Seiko wants to do better, and they never give up. If it takes time, it takes time. But they will ultimately come to the goal that they set out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you've all mentioned both spring drive and quartz, and I think that's an interesting thing that we should definitely talk about here. Is, you know, looking at the traditional high end Swiss manufacturers, There's an almost singular focus on mechanical watchmaking. And today it's almost all automatic watchmaking. I mean, there's some folks are obviously doing high-end hand-wound calibers, but it's really, for the most part, people want like workhorse automatic watches. Grand Seiko clearly doesn't think that's the only option. They think there can be great quartz watches, and they've, you know, really invested heavily in spring drive. I wonder, you know, to... You all know the watch community every bit as well as I do, and to say that there's a bit of snobbery around the idea of traditional mechanical watchmaking might be an understatement. But I wonder how, when you're talking to other watch enthusiasts, maybe you help explain the appeal of spring drive or the place for a high-end quartz watch when maybe some other collectors kind of turn their noses up at the idea of a non-traditional mechanical watch.
Okay, I'll take the spring drive. I'll let Stefan and Daniel talk about the quartz. I love the quartz, but I don't know as much about the 9F as Stefan does, so I'll defer it to him. But in terms of the spring drive technology, I think it's really cool. It's an extremely cool technology. And just to perhaps give it a little bit of background on what that is, right? I mean, spring drive movements are very, very similar to mechanical movements. except that the key difference is that the quote unquote, you know, it's escapement mechanism, right? So in a mechanical movement, the kinetic energy that you get from the mainspring powers through the, you know, the gear train, and as well, well, it's escapement or dissipation, if you will, is regulated by the balanced wheel to keep time. I mean, we know that, you know, all of us watch geeks kind of know that. But in the spring drive calibers, that rotational motion of the mainspring powers the movement, right? But then there's a system that uses a stator and a coil and rotor functions, and it works as an electromagnetic, call it brake. And as that brake is applied, energy or electric rather than kinetic power is generated. It's just like a hybrid car, for example. And so it is this kind of electric energy that is subsequently used to power the integrated circuit, and the quartz oscillator. And then the quartz generates a frequency, which is then communicated to the glide wheel, which is the escapement of the spring drive. And that glide wheel is what allows the time, you know, the watch to keep time. And the frequency there translates into, just to get technical, since we're all geeks, you know, 8 revolutions of the glide wheel per second. So, and the power to activate that, you know, is 0.025 microwatt. That's less than 1/10 of the power consumption of a regular quartz watch. Like, so it's really amazing. And in my view, clearly this is where Seiko and Grand Seiko are betting the future, because there's no doubt in my mind about that, because nobody at Seiko actually told me this, but I believe that there's a reason the Micro Artist Studios in Shojiri, the old Suwa, where the spring drive movements are made, not in Morioka, where the old Dainey and the mechanical watches are produced. Because the most attractive, the most complicated, most well-finished watches produced by Seiko and Grand Seiko today are made in the Micro Artist Studio. You know, I actually had the pleasure to visit it, and it was terrific. You have 9 or 10 folks working there, men and women, you know, making things that are simply among the most beautiful objects produced by mankind today. You know, things like the H2, the 8-day power reserve, the Grand Sonnerie, the minute repeater, and all of those watches, all of them run on spring drive. So to me, it's very clear. I'd love to hear the thoughts of others, but to me, it's very clear that that's where, you know, Grand Seiko is betting the future.
I agree with you, JP. For me, spring drive is also, that is the future. So when it comes to quartz, I mean, if precision is key for you, then I think there is nothing better than quartz, unless you go to atomic controlled or GPS controlled watches, but that's a little bit cheating. So quartz, you get something like plus minus 10 seconds a year, or even plus minus 5 from Grand Seiko. And you don't need more precision than that, I think. And a good thing now with the new 9F85 movement is that finally, again, Grand Seiko has a movement where you have a freely adjustable hour hand, which means that when you're traveling, you do not have to stop this high precision watch. You just pull it out, the crown out to the first step, and then you set the hour hand to the time zone you will be in. Similar to summer and winter time adjustments as well. You do not have to stop the watch. So I think that's really good. I hope they will come with a perpetual calendar as well, as they had in the past in some other watches, not Grand Seiko, but Seiko. Also, the quartz is really low maintenance. Yes, you have to change battery every 3 years, maybe. But the movement itself, the 9F movement, it's basically completely sealed. Some say you don't need to service it within 50 years. I don't think that is the case. But nevertheless, it's really well covered from the surroundings, I would say. And again, a quartz watch is always correct, so you can use it to set your mechanical ones as well.
A good friend of ours, so Joe Kirk from Grand Seiko USA, he said a quote that I think sums up why quartz Grand Seiko should be considered by, I guess, even traditional enthusiasts, traditional mechanical watch enthusiasts. And that is that Grand Seiko 9F movements are quartz for the mechanical watch guy. And I think what he means by that is that they're pretty much engineered to a level that, I guess, even in-house mechanical watches are as well. So you're looking at, so unlike cheap quartz movements that are like when the battery, I guess, dies out, some people might even throw the entire watch away. Whereas Grand Seiko 9F quartz, they're designed to be a lifelong companion. They're designed to, I guess, stick with you forever, as Stefan said. They're even serviceable. They're completely made of metal, which is crazy, with really cool gold tones, and they're even finished in the same way that a lot of the 9S movements are finished, in the sense that they have those Tokyo stripes. It's really cool. The annoying thing about, I know that a lot of Grand Seiko fans that do collect the quartz as well, do get annoyed that a lot of them are solid case backs, but there are some like the, there's the SBGV-238. I know, Stefan, you bought one for your daughter.
I did.
I don't know if you guys can see it there, but it's, you can see that it's got the stripes there. That is nuts, man. That's a quartz watch that's decorated. So, you know that Grand Seiko, they don't cut corners even with their quartz. Like, and I know that traditional watch enthusiasts are really into, I guess, in-house. That's supposed to be respectable, right? Well, even their quartz is like in-house. Everything about it, it's in-house.
Even the battery. That's, you have great, a Seiko battery in your...
Yeah. And they're crystals, man. Like, they grow their own crystals in-house. I think it was 90 days. And it's like you're harvesting vegetables in a veggie patch. Like, they're looking for the best crystal to pick so that they can pair it with the circuit? Sorry, man, I'm not really technical, but that I know that's what they do, and that's just mind blowing. So I guess to sum it up, if that doesn't convince you to try out a quartz, then I don't think anyone can convince you. But for those of you who are curious, give it a go. And they're the most affordable range in the Grand Seiko lineup. Give it a go.
All right. So I want to make sure we have time to get into your actual collections here too. You know, we'll do that. And then I've got some quick fire questions for you guys at the end. But I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about your collections, which is what we really highlighted in the packages we put together in the past. So I wonder, maybe we'll start with Stefan. And I just want to know if each of you can sum up in, you know, two or three sentences, kind of your approach to Grand Seiko collecting.
Yeah, so I like both vintage and modern pieces, and also I am a bit of a collector. So the risk for me when I found Grand Seiko was that it would be good to have every one from the first one in 1960 to the latest. But that's really difficult. It's expensive, time consuming, and to be fair, I don't like everyone. I mean, just because it says Grand Seiko on the dial, I sometimes you don't like it. Might be too small. It might be not looking nice. So I took it down a little bit, sold off most of the vintage pieces because I think they're a little bit fragile and often too small. And then for modern ones, I only buy the ones I like, which is maybe obvious. But if you're a collector, it might not be obvious. So I picked two pieces from my collection. One is the SBGW-033, which was the... piece that they released in 2011 when Seiko was 130 years. So it's a piece looking a lot like the first 3180, but in stainless steel. So this one has the size is very true to the original piece. Later on, they have released several other versions that are slightly bigger. What I like about this one is that the dial is so very nice, creamy kind of dial, and you have a heated blue second hand, and the size is just perfect. And then with this one, I get the modern piece and the vintage piece in the same package, so to speak. So that's an obvious choice. The other one is my SBGE-001 from 2005. So the spring drive GMT with the sapphire bezel, and you have lume numbers under the bezel. It's just, if you look at this one on a flight to Asia or wherever, it's just like a torch. You can lit up the whole cabin with that torch. So that's, I just, that one I like a lot. So those will be my two picks out of the collection.
Great. JP, how would you describe your approach, and what are maybe one or two pieces that you would say represent your collection?
Sure. I think that the logic about my collection of Grand Seiko stems from my love for the vintage line. So I think that there are four seminal pieces that if you're a collector of Grand Seiko, you should own. That's my opinion. You know, the 3180, which is the first GS, the 57 GS, which is the second, the 44 GS, which is the third watch, and then the 62 GS. I think that those are the backbone of my collection, and from my perspective, the most seminal vintage pieces. And everything else for me kind of stems from there. So my collection kind of reflects, in that sense, you know, all the GSs that I own, you know, kind of they sort of arch back to history, if you will. So I don't own any sports GSs like Divers or Chronos, not because I don't like them, but it's, you know, they haven't really found, you know, their way into the collection, if you will. But then the second component, I think, is the Japanese factor that we talked about it. You know, I like Grand Seiko because it's Japanese. It feels Japanese. It speaks with the Japanese DNA. And that's when both, really, Seiko and Grand Seiko are at their best. I don't like very much when you have watches that kind of resemble a Swiss watch. If I want a Swiss watch or a Swiss-looking watch, and then I have many of those in my collection, I'll go ahead and I'll buy a Swiss watch. You know, I like Grand Seiko because they're different, because they're not Swiss. And this is not to bash on the Swiss brands. It's just that identity is what makes it different, right? So pieces in my collection, I would say the vintage 44 GS, and I had actually, quite frankly, several 44 GS's vintages, but I've settled on the reissue, which is the SVG W047. And that to me is the quintessential watch. And I like it a lot. And then the vintage 62, you know, I own the reissue as well, the SVG R097, which I think are really great, you know, sort of, they were great reissues, and it's like really owning an OS, you know, like, you know, watch. So I'll just point out that those two, I think, are key, you know, and there are many, but it's hard to pick those. But I think that the 44 and the 62 are amazing pieces.
Great. And Daniel, let's get your take on this.
Yeah. So my two favorite Grand Seikos are obviously my first Grand Seiko, the SBG W031. Even though I don't own the first Grand Seiko like Stefan and JP, to me, that one represents, I guess, my own history of being acquainted with the brand. And like I said previously, it's my take on, well, I shouldn't say my take, I didn't make it, Grand Seiko's take on the reinterpretation of the first Grand Seiko. So, and I'm a time-only watch guy. Going through your own feed, Stephen, we have very similar taste. And a watch that I previously bought in January was the new SBG K007 with that cool curvy case. The one that it was kind of divided the Grand Seiko collecting community. I happen to love it because it was so different. And mainly, I'll be honest, I loved it because people didn't like it. And I kind of think, because, you know, Grand Seiko is a badass company. And what I like about it is that watches tend to have a certain look. A lot of brands, doesn't matter if they're from Japan or Swiss or Germany even, but this particular design, it's so different. It's curvy, but it's also, it features that Zaratsu polishing that the 44 GS case does, but curved. And I feel like, based on what I've heard, that's really difficult to do. I don't know how they did it. I wish there was a video. And I really like how it's got the, I guess, that quirky, the small seconds on the 9 o'clock position. I think that's really cool. And so for me, I like Grand Seiko because they're different, like what JP and Stefan have said. They're different. The 031 is more of the safe watch, and the 007 is the watch that says, okay, I want to be different from the rest of you guys, so I'm just going to do my thing. And I think Grand Seiko is that kind of brand, a brand that does its own thing.
Mm. Yeah, I like that each of you has your own kind of approach, but that, again, there are some similarities that kind of like make their way through the three collections and your three approaches. And I wonder if, as you guys looked at each other's collections, did any of you see a piece in somebody else's collection and go, ooh, I wish that was in my collection?
all of them.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Wow. Especially when I look at Stefan's collection, you know, it's like, I'll take his 8-day power reserve, you know, the SBG D001 any day of the week. You know, I love the SBG H013, and that's the one with the Arabic, but not wacko Arabic or Breguet numerals. And oh, that's such a beautiful watch. And then yeah. I'm really upset. I mean, I like the SBGA 031, which is a diver, and I don't own it. And at some point, I guess I will. But and I know Stefan owns that one. But I'm really obsessed with the SBGA 071. And that's kind of the 31, but with that, it was a limited edition with a blue purplish dial that is just ridiculously cool. It's just amazing. And you know, our friend Eric Strickland, shout out to Eric, you know, owns one, and I have dibs on it. And I told him, like, if you ever sell it, you know, just give me a call. And but it's a rare watch. It was a limited edition. It's not that easy to find, and you know, in the conditions and you know that one really wants and whatnot. But that is I think from Stefan's collection, that's the one that approaches, you know, that one, and I'll take that one too. On Daniel's collection, I really like, you know, the SBGW 005, you know, because it's like the 31, but with the beads of rice bracelet, which I think it's super cool. And then I like the quartz powered GMT. He has the SBGN 003, that orange GMT hand is off the charts. It's super cool. It's just great. It looks fantastic.
Man, this is going to be a bit awkward, but I kind of sold off both of them to get the 007. So, but let's pretend that I do have them still,
Dave. Steph's got to come and go.
Well, I don't know, man. You know, your collection changes quickly. I don't know. You know,
it's difficult to keep up. I caught quite a bit of hate from a couple of my followers. They're like, why are you selling everything? Man, life happens, you know? Yeah, from Stefan's collection, man, and your collection as well, JP. I wouldn't know which one to pick, but from Stefan's collection, I think you had the SBGW 252? You've got that one, right?
25.
The first Grand Seiko reissue, but in yellow gold?
Yeah.
Now I'm with you. Yes.
I know you
did. I still have it.
I love that watch. Like, I love yellow, golden, gray.
That one is great.
I would say that would be the one from your collection that I'll take. And from JP's collection, man, like, I was going to say, you've got the, which one is it? You just recently bought, the Ichi-2. Even
yes,
though it's a Grand Seiko, man, that's like way out of my budget. But, man, I could just look at yours and, So I would say that one. And I also love your Wacko model, the one with the cool Arabic. Oh, that's...
Yeah, the SBG H031, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's really cool as well. I love that watch too. Yeah, thanks.
I agree with Daniel. from JP, I would, for sure, even though it's not the Grand Seiko, I would take that H2. No doubt. But since we're on Grand Seiko, I picked one that they actually have. And I think if there is something that shouts Grand Seiko, at least modern Grand Seiko, it's the dial of the snowflake. You still have it, JP, I guess?
Yeah, I do.
When I saw this one the first time, wow, I don't think there's anything watch-related ever that blew my mind as much as this dial. It's really something else. So I got it very early on. Then I sold it. Maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like this. And then I tried to buy it back from my friend, and he didn't sell it until, I think it was early last year. I bought the very same piece back again. So finally, I have it. So the Snowflake SBGA 011, that is one Grand Seiko to have in any collection, I would say.
I love that JP wears his snowflake on a strap instead of a bracelet as well, which is kind of a controversial move with some folks. But personally, I'm a fan. I'll tell you that, JP.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I love it. And it's the cool thing about the snowflake is that you can wear it with pretty much any strap. Yeah. I mean, I'm currently wearing it with a blue strap and it looks really great, you know, and I've worn it with like so many different colors and I think it looks great. I mean, I have an Hermes, you know, strap, like totally bright, you know, orange, Hermes orange strap that I think looks really cool with that watch. You know, it's very cool. It's very versatile from that perspective, you know.
True.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
And from Daniel, that SPG case 007, I need to get me one of those. I do have the 009, so the gray dial with the bracelet. But that pale one, oh, it looks so good. It looks also, you get that vintage feeling and you get that quirkiness from the power reserve, and some people hate it. I love it. Normally, I don't like open case backs, but on the manual wind watch, it's perfect. You see that very, very nice 9S63 movement. So that would be my pick from your collection.
You guys all made good choices. I think I would take any of those any of those watches and be a very happy man. All right, I want to make sure we get to this lightning round. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask a question, and then I'd love Stefan, then JP, then Daniel to answer. And that order is because that is the order of your windows in my Zoom window. So I'm making it easy on myself here. I promise there's no motive to this order other than convenience for me. So so I'll just ask a question, and if each of you can give me an answer, that would be great. All right, let's start this thing off. If you had to choose vintage or modern,
I would pick modern, but with a vintage twist.
Good answer.
I am gonna cop out. So both, sorry.
All right, that's fair. I'll let you have that one.
I'm gonna go modern.
Okay, so we've got a nice mix here. I like that. If we gotta go bracelet or strap, and you can only pick one, which do you pick?
This is tough, but okay, bracelet.
Oh, strap.
Strap on me too.
Ooh.
All right. We already got our answer from Stefan to this, but I'll have you say it again. Solid case back or display case back?
I actually picked solid, except for when you have a hand-wound movement. I want that lion on the back.
Oh, to me, it's a display case back. I mean, if you look at an H2, HE2, and that's all you need, it's mesmerized. I mean, it'd be a shame, a crime to hide that.
But that's not the Grand Seiko, so that's okay.
fair enough. But I think that as you know, the 8-day power reserve, you know, is a Grand Seiko, and I would say the same thing about that watch.
Oh, but it's also hand wound, so it fits with my pick.
Oh, that's sure.
Daniel, how about you?
I'm gonna say the same thing as well. Well, if it's a manual wind dress watch, it'll be great to have it with a display case back. With any of the two watches, take care to hide it. Put a solid case.
All right. Time only or complications?
Time only with power reserve on the back.
Good answer.
I'll go with time only as well. Yeah.
I too. And
yeah, power reserve on the back. I agree with that. Sorry.
I too will go for time only.
I think this is the unofficial time only podcast we've got going on right here. My complicated watches have date windows. It's very adventurous. It's all right. What's your favorite modern Grand Seiko reference? And by modern, I mean something that's like currently available today. Something you could go to a retailer and buy right now.
I'll pick a SPG W007, which is a white gold hand wound model. With a 7-piece link bracelet.
That's amazing.
I want it.
From the current collection, I would pick the SBGJ. Pick your color. I mean, I think it's the high beat GMT with the 9S86. I mean, tremendous bang. And I think that's the only, as far as I know, it's the only high beat GMT, like true GMT movement that is currently being produced, you know, or mass produced, I should say. You know, so any watches from that particular series, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. The blue sort of textured dial version is just absolutely lights out. That watch is so good.
Oh my God. And the Mount Iwate dials that were introduced in that series as well. It's been like, for the modern pieces, I mean, it's just my favorite one, and you know, it's great.
Yeah. So I should be saying the SBG W231, cause that's the updated version of the 031. I would have to say if I were to, like, let's say all my watches went missing, let's hope that doesn't happen, so knock on wood. I would probably go for the SBG V205, which is a quartz, because I need that as a teacher. Like, who's got time to wind? No offense. And it's got the 44GS interpretation case with that cool heated blue seconds. And that champagne dial, amazing. I'll probably go for that one.
And you should wait.
Very nice.
Then you should wait for the new one with the 9F85.
Ah, don't tell me that. Yeah. I'm already broke
stuff. I'll send you a link.
Send me a link. Go away.
I'm gonna throw my own answer in that in the ring here, which is I'm completely obsessed with the SBGA 413 lately, which is the cherry blossom dial.
Yeah.
Spring drive. If you had told me that like my one of my favorite watches of the last year would be a pink dial spring drive with a 62GS inspired case, which is maybe my least favorite of all of the vintage Grand Seiko cases. I get it. I like it. It's just not one that, like, you know, blows my mind usually. This watch is just absolutely incredible. Every time I see one, I kind of reach for my wallet and have to think twice, but I think that one may end up in my collection at some point.
That's a good choice, Stephen. Very good choice.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I'm biased.
No. Oh no, you guys
own it.
You guys are fanning the flames here. It's you know, it's nine. It's only 9 a.m. in New York City, and I'm already thinking about buying a watch. That's dangerous. What's your favorite vintage Grand Seiko reference? Let's do that one as well.
Sure.
Yeah, I would pick some 45GS. Actually, I like the hands on those models. It's manual wound, so it's much smaller, and the cases look brilliant. So, 45GS.
I would go with the first Grand Seiko, the GS first with the 3180 movement, just because that's where it all started. That's where it all started. So it's reference to that.
For design reasons, I would probably go with the 45GS as well. I think it's just much, yeah, seeing it in person, oh my God, like you can get one with date and no date. I prefer the no date. But in terms of history and I guess literature, if you want to call it that, I would probably go with the first Grand Seiko because I just love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a kind of goofy question here. So Grand Seiko doesn't really do brand ambassadors, you know, not in the way that some of the big Swiss companies do it. There's no, like, you know, Oscar winning movie star on a Grand Seiko billboard, you know, looking pensively at the camera. That doesn't really happen. But if you could pick anyone in the world to be a Grand Seiko ambassador, who would you pick and what watch would you put on their wrist?
So I would pick George Clooney. And I would put an SBG K007 on his wrist. I think it would suit him perfectly.
I dig that. That's a good choice.
I would pick Jay-Z. And I think that he would look totally awesome with the SVG W263. And that's one of the watches that they launched this year to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the brand. So that watch is the one that has an 18 carat white gold dial. It's hand engraved by one of their, like, I think it's their best, you know, master engraver. His name is Kiyoshi Terui. And Kiyoshi Terui-san is an incredible individual. I had the pleasure to meet him. His work is fantastic. It's phenomenal. So this is a 39 millimeter platinum case, 20 pieces only, 9S64 caliber. So Jay-Z rocking that piece in a tux at the Grammys, that would be pretty cool.
That'd be pretty awesome.
So mine would be, there's this Taiwanese Japanese actor, his name is Takeshi Kaneshiro. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. He's in, he starts in that movie Redcliffe. I don't know if you've heard of it. Anyway, it's so I'll probably pick him. Now, I don't know if I can say this because he was ambassador for Citizen, which is like Japan, Grand Seiko's rival. So, but if I couldn't pick him, gotta go with Gary Steingart, man. And I would put CGW033 on his wrist. So come on, Gary, let's make it happen, man.
Gary's already an unofficial Grand Seiko ambassador. I don't think they're paying him anything, but he's certainly spreading the word.
Sorry, Gary.
That's funny.
All right, and the last kind of quick fire question, then we'll start to wrap things up. Is what's your Grail Grand Seiko watch? The one watch, it can be vintage, it can be modern, but the watch that, you know, if you were able to get your hands on one and add it to the collection, that would be it. That would be the crown jewel of your collection.
Yeah, I would actually pick a full set 4580 7010 VFA. I love that dial. You have Grand Seiko on top in capital letters. You have the VFA and a Daini symbol at 6, and that's it. It's so clean. Hands are nice, and markers are also really, really nice. And again, it's a 45GS, so that would be my pick.
That's such an incredible watch.
Yeah, it's an amazing watch. I mean, for me, it's the Grand Seiko First in Platinum. Mm. That would be it. Mm. But I think that the VFAs are terrific as well. If I had to pick, I have two VFAs that I love, which is the 6186-8000, but I like it with a blue dial, which is the, you know, rarer. And the 4580-7000 with a blue dial, that's amazing too, you know. But if I had to pick one, I'd have to go with the GS First in Platinum.
I don't know if I have a Grail. Like, I would say if I could like just keep one watch that I currently have, it would be the 031. I'd be pretty content with that. But if I were to pick one, I'll probably go to Sweden, break into Stefan's house, and take his SBGW252.
Oh, okay.
And that'll be my Grail.
You're welcome.
We can get you your own. You don't have to take Stefan's. We'll keep his. But
yes, to be sure, Daniel, is it this one? This is the one you mean, no?
Yes.
One man. Wow, that's so hot. Oh, I love
man.
It.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, it's amazing.
I think we may have to have you guys back to do a deep dive into VFAs and Grand Seiko firsts at some point. I mean, I might be the only person who wants to listen to that show, but I personally want to have that conversation. So we might have to circle back and do that. But I want to thank you guys for doing this. I know this logistically was, you know, some of us are getting ready for bed. Some of us are just having our first cup of coffee or tea right now. It's pretty cool. And I think a nice testament to the Grand Seiko community that we can do something like this, that we have people across 14 hours worth of time zones all getting together to talk about this formerly esoteric, impossible to learn about Japanese watch brand. And I wonder if just to finish, maybe I'd love a thought from each of you about that aspect of Grand Seiko, about the kind of community aspect. And, you know, aside from the physical watches themselves, what is it that you guys love about being Grand Seiko collectors? So maybe let's start with Daniel and then do Stefan and then JP.
What I like about the Grand Seiko community is that we're almost like a family. And speaking of family, I've got a new Instagram account. Sorry, guys. I've got a new Instagram account.
Plug away, man. That's what this is for.
Oh, thanks, Steven. There you go. Well, Grand Seiko family, guys, it's a place to learn about Grand Seiko. But even if you don't want to follow that, that's cool too. But speaking about the collectors out there, they're so knowledgeable and so willing to just give you information. And I don't really see that much flexing as you do in other, I guess, watch communities or, I don't know, communities. Like, sometimes there's dedicated groups for dedicated brands. But the Grand Seiko one, like, everybody seems to be very, I'm forgetting the word here, but willing to give out information. I think that's really cool. And there's no scrutiny for, like, if you don't know anything about watches or about Grand Seiko, everybody's willing to share. And I think that's great.
I fully agree with Daniel on this. It's like a family, but I think everyone is welcome. Everyone is friendly. No one looks down on you if you ask stupid questions or if you don't know. And also, most people like to share. I mean, the findings, and there isn't much literature about the Grand Seiko. The one literature that do exist is in Japanese, which can be tough for most of us to read. And some nice people like Gerald, for instance, he has been scanning catalogs and listing all the vintage Grand Seikos, every single piece, and you can read everything about it. So I think that's, and he's doing it for free. So I think that's, everyone seems to be friendly. In the beginning, it was more like, or when I started, in Sweden, no one knew about it, so you were fairly alone. At some point, I think all the Grand Seiko pieces that you could buy secondhand was coming from me, basically. That is not the case. It's a much bigger following. But somehow, the community has been able to keep this family kind of feeling around Grand Seiko. It's still very small compared to some other brands, but I hope that we can keep that. And personally, I've met so many people, both IRL and online, due to my Grand Seiko collecting. I mean, I met JP, was it 3-4 years ago here in Stockholm? That was a nice thing.
Oh, God, it was awesome, yeah. Totally. I'll take it from there. You know, I couldn't agree more. I think this is a very... open community. And to me, I was actually reluctant to jump on Instagram. It took me a while. I used to look at Instagram a lot, but it took a while. And then when I started posting, the watches in my collection there, which are, the collection is really barbelled between Grand Seiko and everything else. And, so the response was really, really interesting. So when I started the watchers, there wasn't really, I had no intentions apart from I've seen some pretty cool watches. Let me just put something back or give something back there. And that paved the way for me to get to know so many, great people, the two here, me being just two of the great people that I've met through this particular community. And I agree. I think it's a community that it's in many ways, I don't know if it's related to the idea of being Seiko and Grand Seiko fans, people who collect those pieces, and there's not the quote unquote snob factor that much. So that makes the community a lot more selfless, I would say. There's no, I don't see a lot of bragging. There's more like, this is, Grand Seiko fans are usually Seiko fans as well. So what they're, so you're able to appreciate an HE2 and a Seiko 5 for what they are. And I think that when you're talking about a community that really spans, that level of the spectrum is so wide that, you know that those guys are in for the watches. They're not in for the bling, or they're not in for the brand per se, but the they're not in for just the logo, let's put it that way. They're in for the watches and for what it means to them and that connection. And because Seiko itself is an entry point for so many people that are starting their collections. I mean, we've talked about it today, and I think that a lot of folks got introduced to mechanical watches, via a Seiko 5 or a lower end Seiko. So I think that that's what's so great about the community. It's really cool.
Yeah, I just want to add on to Stefan as well, and what JP was saying, that everybody is so willing to share information. So Gerald, who he's talking about, is Watch DXB on Instagram. I think you had an episode with Mark Cho. Mark Cho gave him a shout out. So I'll give him another shout out again as well. Because that guy, I would annoy him with questions. And he probably knows that I'm not buying anything. I'm just asking him because I want to learn about it. And he's happy to just continuously share. And there's another dude from Australia as well. He's more of a Seiko guy, but Seiko, his name is Paul. He's always like willing to share his knowledge as well. So those two blokes, awesome.
Well, Anthony Cable as well, a guy that needs to be, because he's, if we're talking shout outs, I mean, Anthony is a tremendous source of information and, talking about selfless. I mean, he, information that he has on his site, his Instagram account is just amazing. So shout out to him. And I had mentioned Eric before. He's also a great friend and a tremendous collector, like an incredible collection spanning through Seiko, Grand Seiko, vintage. Like, it's amazing. And he's a really super, super, super nice guy.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, basically everybody you guys have mentioned here are people that have been instrumental in my own experience as a Grand Seiko collector and fan. And it's pretty amazing that we can sit here again across so many time zones and we know so many of the same people and have learned from each other. And it's a really fantastic kind of subset of watch collecting. And I think, you know, for anybody maybe who hasn't dipped their toes yet or gotten into it, hopefully our conversation here has given them a taste of maybe what they can experience if they're interested. So, yeah, we'll provide links to everybody down in the show notes to everyone we just shouted out and to the three of you and to your collector profile. So hopefully people can start going deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole once they're done listening. But I want to thank you guys for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. Again, I know it's late for some of us, early for others of us. Thank you guys for doing this, for sharing your knowledge, sharing your passion. And hopefully we can get nerdy again sometime soon.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you all.
Thanks, Stephen. Really great. I hope we can do it in New York next time.
Yeah, I would love that. Hopefully soon. Hopefully very, very soon. Yeah.
Amen to that. Amen to that.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.